And good evening. It's happened. The Mueller report finally goes to the Department of Justice. Chelsea Manning takes another stand, and is Julian Assange about to leave the Ecuadorian embassy? With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Friday, March 22, 2019. First to headlines with Linda Perry.
The Department of Justice says Robert Mueller has delivered his final report to Attorney General William Barr, who is reviewing it. Barr says he could update the Congress as early as this weekend about Special Counsel Mueller's findings in the Russia investigation. The report concludes Mueller's nearly two-year-long investigation of Russian election meddling and possible coordination with Donald Trump's campaign. The report, still confidential, sets the stage for big public fights to come. Next steps are up to Trump's attorney general, to Congress, and in all likelihood, federal courts. We'll have more about the Mueller report in this broadcast. Turning to New Zealand, its deputy prime minister said the gunman accused of killing 50 people in two mosques in the South Pacific nation would spend the rest of his life in isolation in prison, and called for solidarity to eradicate hate-filled ideologies. Winston Peters was speaking at an emergency session of the 57-member Organization of Islamic Cooperation's Executive Committee. It was called by Turkey to combat prejudice against Muslims in the wake of the attack. Peter's attendance comes amid controversy sparked by Turkish President Erdogan, who at election campaign rallies has been screening video clips of the attack, despite efforts by New Zealand to prevent the video spread. Erdogan also drew Australia's ire for comments suggesting that Australians and New Zealanders with anti-Muslim sentiment would be sent back in coffins like their ancestors who fought against Turks in World War I, and he slammed populist politicians who he said encourage attacks on Muslims and refugees. Erdogan also called for neo-Nazi groups to be considered terrorists. If we don't show our reaction in a strong manner, he said, the neo-Nazi virus will engulf the body even more. If we don't raise our voices, Western governments will not disrupt their comfort. This morning, New Zealanders observed the Muslim call to prayer, reflecting on the moment 1 week ago when worshippers at two Christchurch mosques were slain. An act that an imam told the crowd of thousands had left the country broken-hearted but not broken. People across New Zealand listened to the call to prayer on live broadcasts. Thousands, including Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, gathered in a park opposite the Al Noor Mosque. That's where 42 people died. She said, New Zealand mourns with you. We are one. Then thousands gathered for a mass funeral to bury 26 of the victims of the mosque attacks, the youngest victim of the attacks, 3-year-old Mukad Ibrahim. Here at home, to coincide with afternoon prayers, Muslims, Jews, and Christians stood together in solidarity. The faith community gathered at several sites throughout New York City, Long Island, and Westchester to form a ring of peace around several mosques. This similar to what the Muslim community did after the Tree of Life synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres attended prayer services at New York City's first mosque, that's the Islamic Cultural Center of New York. He expressed solidarity with the Muslim community, and he urged people to reaffirm the sanctity of all places of worship.
Around the world, we have seen ever-rising anti-Muslim hatred, anti-Semitism, hate speech, and bigotry. I have repeatedly warned about those dangers. Hate speech is spreading like wildfire. Social media is being exploited as a platform for bigotry, and public discourse is being coarsened. Many political movements are either openly admitting their neo-Nazi affiliation or lip-syncing their words and cutting and pasting the symbols and images. That cancer is spreading. And it is our duty to find the cure.
UN Chief Guterres announced that he was asking the head of the UN Alliance of Civilizations to develop an action plan so all UN bodies can help safeguard religious sites. In other news, Donald Trump tweeted today that he reversed his administration's decision to slap new sanctions on North Korea. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said in a statement that Trump likes Chairman Kim and doesn't think these sanctions will be necessary. The White House on Thursday said sanctions were evidence the U.S. was maintaining pressure on North Korea in an effort to coax its leader to give up his nuclear weapons program. This is the latest example of Trump's style of governing through Twitter, which leaves officials scrambling to figure out what he's directing and what they should implement. Turning to the Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign, the Democratic Socialists of America endorsed the Vermont senator in his second run for president. The New York-based group says its National Political Committee voted Thursday to endorse Sanders and move forward with an independent campaign to elect him and advance a class struggle agenda. The 56,000-member organization calls Sanders the only Democratic Socialist running for president in 2020 and the only Socialist in American history with a serious chance of winning the presidency. And in local news, there's finally some justice for Hawa Ba in the death of her son, Mohammed. The city agreed to pay $1.9 million to the mother of the mentally distraught man who was killed by police in his Harlem apartment back in 2012. And the city dropped its appeal. Ba says the NYPD showed up at Mohammed's apartment with heavy weaponry like they were going to war. They broke down his door even though I told them to go away because I wanted an ambulance. Since then, the NYPD's crisis intervention training has proven to be totally ineffective. In Mohammed's name, Hawa Ba says, I am fighting for the NYPD to be eliminated as first responders to people in emotional crisis like my son was. I don't want any other mother or family to have to face the suffering I've had to endure. Back over to you, Paul.
Thanks, Linda. And the report by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller is now in the hands of the United States Attorney General William Barr. The next step is up to the Department of Justice, and it's not a sure deal the report will be ever made public. James Henry is an investigative economist and a global justice fellow at Yale. He's been closely following the trials and tribulations of President Donald Trump.
Apparently, there's a letter that's gone to the House Judiciary Committee saying that Mueller has submitted will submit his report by 5 p.m. East Coast time Friday. So I gather that means it's already in. But we don't, you know, the Attorney General is going to review it, and then there'll be issues about to what extent it is shared with Congress. I'm sure Congress will want to know what's in it. And, you know, at this point, we have no real reason to expect there to be a fight, but Barr has said that it's going to explain his Mueller is going to explain his reasoning about the prosecuting decisions he made and the declinations he made. So, you know, the next step will be for Congress to try to get its hands on the report.
Is that an issue? Was there ever an issue in the past of Congress getting their hands on a report from a special prosecutor?
Well, there's been quite a bit of speculation about what whether, you know, the Department of Justice would actually share it with Congress. I mean, there's resolutions that have been passed that called for him to do so. But, you know, he could take the position that he could be a stickler on this business, but I suspect that he will ultimately end up sharing it with Congress. The question is in what format and to what extent all of the extensive investigation notes will be shared with Congress. And, you know, it's a classic case of executive versus legislative procedure here. But I think, you know, the big questions for us as citizens are what difference does it make? I mean, I think a lot of media have exaggerated the importance of the Mueller report. Practically speaking, we're not going to have the Justice Department indict a sitting president. That would just overturn too much precedent. Secondly, impeachment would require 67 votes in the Senate if it was going to be a conviction. Right now, you know, there's 45 Democrats and two independents. So we really need the 22 seats, Republican senators that are up for election in 2020 to be ousted. And by that time, we will have had a presidential election. So in terms of actually changing the White House incumbent, the thing people have to focus on is what will this report and the congressional investigations that are surrounding it reveal that will influence the election. And it may be that there are indictments or recommendations that come down, not necessarily just from Mueller, but maybe from, say, the Southern District in New York that involves some of the Trump family members. And so one scenario would be such indictments put pressure on Trump to reconsider whether he really wants to stay in the White House and fight this out. But on the other hand, to the extent that there's criminal activity that surfaced here, his immunity from prosecution would not survive his losing the White House. So he has, you know, many more incentives to stay and fight hard to stay, to be reelected, oddly enough, if the Mueller report indicates that there's criminal behavior that they've surfaced. So I suspect that, you know, there's going to be quite a bit of subsequent investigation that has to go on the part of the Congress to really fill in the blanks here. And secondly, there are topics like the role of firms like Cambridge Analytica in intervening in elections. Some of the European authorities are now getting interested in investigating some of the behavior across borders. So it's going to be some time, I think, before we're really able to say definitively how important the Mueller investigation has been and compared to all the other investigations that are going on.
And James Henry is an investigative economist and a global justice fellow at Yale. And in news that's just coming over the wire, the latest in the special counsel Robert Mueller investigation, the special counsel is not recommending any further indictments into the Russia investigation. That's according to the Associated Press, who reports on that an official speaking for the Justice Department on condition of anonymity, because the person wasn't authorized to speak publicly, has said that Mueller notified Attorney General William Barr on Friday that he included his and we're just going on here. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham expects that he and the panel's top Democrat, Senator Dianne Feinstein, will be briefed in the coming days about Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report. The South Carolina Republican says he was notified by the Justice Department that Mueller's report had been turned over and that the Attorney General will pursue as much transparency as possible. Graham says he expects to be more thoroughly briefed. He says he's believed it was important for Mueller to do his job without interference, and that has been accomplished. Meanwhile, in London, police are reportedly gathering at the Ecuadorian embassy where WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been holed up. It was revealed that a Washington, D.C. area grand jury has been investigating Assange when whistleblower Chelsea Manning was jailed for contempt when she refused to answer questions before that grand jury. Del Cameron is a staff reporter for Gizmodo. He's been following Manning's case.
She's being detained in Virginia. She's being held on a contempt charge for refusing to give testimony about WikiLeaks to a grand jury investigating Julian Assange.
And what is that? What is the law behind that? Why does that happen?
Well, she's basically they pulled her in to answer questions about her testimony that she gave during her 2013 court martial. When you get pulled into a grand jury, you don't have the right to plead the fifth because immunity is forced on you. So if you go in and refuse to answer questions, you go to a contempt hearing, and then a judge can put you in jail for, I think the limit is about 18 months. Basically because it's not supposed to be punitive, it's supposed to be coercive. It's meant to coerce you into cooperating with the prosecution.
Now, what is Chelsea's position on, is she coercible?
I don't think so. I mean, she was in jail for 7 years. Some of that time was spent in Kuwait. She spent her pretrial confinement was rather rough. I mean, she spent time, up to you know, I think 18 hours a day or 16 hours a day. She wasn't allowed to exercise. She wasn't allowed to lay down. I mean, she's been in some pretty rough conditions. You know, the UN's special reporter on cruel and inhumane treatment basically said that the treatment of her was constituted torture under the UN's definition of that. So I think she knew what she was getting herself into, and she's likely to, you know, be able to hold out for 18 months, which is something that, like, a lot of people probably can do. If anything, you know, she was definitely aware that of what it was going to be like when she went back to jail.
Uh-huh. Now, if you can't be coerced, and it's obvious you can't be coerced, doesn't the judge even have to release you at that point?
Yeah, the judge will have to release her. The rules, I believe, are 18 months is like kind of the maximum for that. Usually that's, you know, people don't really stay in that long. I think, it's all on the judge's discretion. So, I mean, if the judge becomes convinced sooner that, you know, this isn't going to work and she's just not going to break. I think the term that the judge used was purge. He was going to keep her in jail until she purged. You know, the judge technically should, at that point, when he or she is convinced it's not going to happen, should let them out. Because, again, it's not meant to be punitive. She's not in jail because she's committed a crime. She's not charged with a crime. The other thing is that, you know, if the grand jury is dissolved at any point, they have to let her out immediately.
So now we know that there is a grand jury looking into Julian Assange.
Right. We don't know specifically what charges they're bringing against him. You know, there's talk about how difficult it would be to convict him under the Espionage Act. You know, there's some standards that they have to meet. For instance, you know, they would have to prove that he specifically was trying to harm the United States by acquiring, you know, classified material and disclosing it, that was his intention, not just to publish it for purposes of transparency. I think it's probably far more likely that they're looking for another way to charge him with something that's a little bit easier to prove, something that doesn't carry so many consequences for the, you know, First Amendment, doesn't bring up as many First Amendment issues, potentially, you know, that he helped hackers who acquired information from American companies or the government itself. You know, if at any point Julian Assange gave a computer hacker advice, or in one case we know that he provided hackers with some code that allowed them to comb through the 5 million emails that were stolen from Stratfor, the private intelligence firm down in Austin, Texas, that they acquired those emails and are part of the WikiLeaks database. He helped those hackers look through them. So, you know, there's easier ways to bring charges against him other than espionage.
This is as much about, if not more, about Julian Assange than Chelsea Manning.
Well, it's definitely mostly about Julian Assange. And, you know, what happened yesterday is that the prosecution hasn't formally accused her of making any misleading statements in her court-martial testimony. That was something that they said outside of the courtroom, but it appears that the prosecution at least thinks that may have happened, and they want to question her again about her testimony because they think maybe she's given some conflicting statements once she got out of prison about, you know, her motives and her communications with WikiLeaks. It's my understanding that Manning did not refuse to answer questions to defend Julian Assange. She actually has some issues with the grand jury system itself, with the fact that it's secretive, and with the fact that in the past it's been used to target activists. And I think that she's taking she has some moral issues with the grand jury system.
And that's Del Cameron, a staff reporter for Gizmodo. And in these fast-moving news days, it's come to our attention that there's currently no police action at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, but we will be keeping watch on that. And you're listening to the news on Pacifica Radio WBAI in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. A judge has struck down laws here in the United States that Wisconsin Republicans passed in December's lame duck session of the state legislature, restoring powers to Democratic Governor Tony Evers, if only temporarily. A county judge ruled on Thursday that all of the laws and appointments passed by legislators were unlawful because they met in what's known as an extraordinary session, which isn't explicitly allowed under the state's constitution. Evers seized on the decision almost immediately, calling on Wisconsin Department of Justice, led by Democratic Attorney General Josh Call, to withdraw the state from a lawsuit that seeks to overturn the Affordable Care Act. The lead attorney representing the people of Wisconsin against the state legislators' action is Jeff Mandel. He says it was an illegal power grab by the GOP.
After the November election here in Wisconsin, in which Democrats swept the statewide offices for the first time in quite a long time, the legislature decided to hold another floor session and pass a number of bills that really worked to take powers away from the then incoming governor and the then incoming attorney general, both Democrats, and give those powers to the legislature. So a stark departure from past practice. It's a stark departure from what we understand the basic premise of separation of powers to be, and the way we have peaceful transfers of power, in the United States. So that's where we started. And what our lawsuit did is we looked carefully at the procedures that are set forth in the Wisconsin Constitution about how the legislature is allowed to meet. And we allege, and the court yesterday fully agreed with us, that the Wisconsin Constitution does not allow the legislature to convene itself in what they aptly, they being the legislature, not the court, but what the legislature itself aptly calls an extraordinary session. That's just something that the Constitution doesn't anticipate and doesn't authorize.
What's the nature of the ruling? What do they say in that ruling?
The court agreed with our legal theory and with our assessment that the arguments the legislature has put forth in support of its actions are completely without merit. And as a result, the court said that session did not lawfully happen. It was not convened in accord with the Constitution, and every law that was passed at that session is unenforceable. The court issued an order stopping the enforcement of all the laws and vacating 82 appointments by then-Governor Walker to various boards and commissions and agencies in the state that the Senate had confirmed during that extraordinary session.
Attorney Jeff Mandel joining us from Madison, Wisconsin. The lawsuit was brought by a coalition of plaintiffs that includes the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin, Disability Rights Wisconsin, and Black Leaders Organizing for Communities. A federal judge ruled against Republicans in January, blocking laws that were passed in the lame duck session that limited early voting. And finally, state lawmakers in New York have voted to block plans for a massive trash incinerator proposed for the Finger Lakes region. By unanimous vote, the state Senate passed legislation Wednesday that would prohibit the project from moving forward. The Assembly passed the bill last week. Governor Andrew Cuomo has already expressed objections to the project. Environmental groups and local residents had opposed plans for the incinerator between Seneca and Cayuga Lake, citing concerns about the environment, agriculture, and tourism. Yvonne Taylor is a local activist.
Incineration is not a good solution to landfilling because no matter how advanced the technology is, it is still emitting, this particular facility would emit 1 million tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year. And along with that, it would emit very, very toxic chemicals like dioxins, which are the most dangerous substance known to man. There is no safe level. Those toxins bioaccumulate in the body, which means you cannot get rid of them. So pregnant women would be passing these chemicals on to their children. It also happens to be located a mere 3,200 feet from a K-12 school and another residential facility for at-risk youth. in the heart of Finger Lakes wine country.
What would this incinerator have burned?
It would be burning solid waste from homes in places like New York City and also construction debris waste.
And how would it get there, the waste?
It would be trucked in at just under 3,000 tons of garbage a day to start with. And then later on in the plan, they planned on bringing it in by train as well.
So there was some opposition to this in the community?
There is not a single person in the community, either residents, families, business owners, or elected officials who are in favor of this project. The only people in favor of the project is the company that's proposing it.
What passed in the legislature? What was this bill?
It passed both unanimously in both the Assembly and the Senate. It's called the Finger Lakes Community Preservation Act of 2019. It was introduced by Senator Rachel May from Syracuse and also Assembly Member Michael Cusick. And it would essentially prohibit new construction of any garbage burning facility within the Finger Lakes watershed. The Finger Lakes is not saying not in my backyard. The Finger Lakes is currently receiving over 50% of New York State's garbage already.
Where does that go? The garbage that goes there already, where does that go?
Into the Seneca Meadow landfill and the Ontario County landfill at 10,000 tons of garbage a day. The proposed incinerator would not alleviate that amount. It would just be an additional 3,000 tons a day into our area. I think we're doing our fair share here in the Finger Lakes. And, you know, we also have a burgeoning wine and tourism industry that brings in $3 billion per year into New York State's economy and supports 58,000 jobs. If you're going to be bringing in additional garbage trucks and a 260-foot smokestack that can be seen on a beautiful, I mean, you wouldn't put something like this in Sonoma Valley, California, in the middle of wine country there. So I'm not sure what people are thinking about trying to put it in the heart of Finger Lakes wine country.
Yvonne Taylor is a community activist in the Finger Lakes region of New York State. The facility was the company behind the project, Rochester-based Circular Energy, has argued that the incinerator would have created clean energy by burning trash that otherwise would be landfilled. And that's some of the news for Friday, March 22nd, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks so much for joining us.